You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Well, hello, friends. My guest on this episode is Matthew James Jones. The choice we talk about is him making the choice to leave his military career in order to pursue a career as a writer. But before I can talk to him about leaving the military, I ask him about his choice to join the military. And then we talk about the process of shifting from the military to writing his newly published book, which was not an overnight process. I will be honest, this conversation both went places I completely expected it to, and also all kind of places I did not expect. Matt talks about trauma as a soldier. He makes a valiant attempt to get me to talk about U.S. politics that I hope I deftly sidestep. And there is a guest appearance from Claudia the Cat, just to mention a few of the fun things that come up. So if you're ready, I'm ready. Let's do this. Matthew James Jones, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. Are you ready for a fun chat?
I am highly caffeinated and ready to go.
Very good. And for those of you watching the video, the second guest is Claudia. Claudia, the friend here for the interview. I begin every interview by asking my guests where they call home and where they're talking to me from. So where do you live?
Well, initially, I am a Canadian, although currently you find me in a little suburb of Paris called Pantin, which is just a bit to the north along a lovely canal on a
Very
beautiful
nice.
sunny day with all sorts of glorious people walking up and down the canal, sitting on terraces, sipping drinks. It's quite idyllic here after we've, survived the so-called winter.
Very nice. Yeah, absolutely. So in a second, we'll get to the topic of the day. But before we do that, I want to get one more a bit of information about you as a person. Outside of work and outside of your family, would you like to share with us a hobby, a pastime, a passion project, something that you enjoy doing?
Well, most of me has gotten sucked into the whirlwind of book promotion right now.
Yeah.
But I do keep one thread going, which is, of course, fitness life. I started a workout club a few years back, basically for veterans. And the premise is that we're lifting logs in the forest.
Okay.
Over the years, it has developed and it has grown. And now we just mostly run around in parks along the aforementioned canal. But it remains the log gym. I run the log gym, basically.
That is amazing. I've asked a lot of people that question, and that's the first time somebody said that they lift logs in the forest. So I love that. I love that. All right, the topic of the day, what we're going to talk about is you making the decision to leave the security of the military to become a writer. Does that sound like a decent conversation?
I am ready to do this.
Let's do
All
it.
of the old fear and paralysis is surging back now that the topic has come up.
Okay, I think that's good. Fresh top of mind. All right, let's back up, because before you could decide to leave the military, you had to decide to join the military. I know from the information you told me about you as a person on the intake form that you say you joined when you were 19. Do you remember what appealed to you and what attracted you to the idea of joining the military, the Canadian military at that point?
Amy, I am more than what I wrote on the intake form.
Okay.
I am more than your intake form, okay? Well, I remember when I was 18, 19 years old, I was living in a little town, Kingston, Ontario, which is about 2 hours outside of Ottawa, the capital. People should know the capital. And I was working in an American chain restaurant called the Lone Star. In the kitchen, in the lowest rung of the kitchen hierarchy, which is, of course, the dishwasher. If you're familiar with the Lone Star restaurant, you know that they serve buckets of guacamole, buckets of nacho cheese. So at some point, there is one poor bastard at the end of his shift who has to cut the crusted nacho out with an actual knife and scrape out the rotting green gunk of the guacamole container. So at some point, doing that job, I was like, hey, you know what? I was wearing a hairnet, so this glory was shielded from the world. And I said, I think my ambition actually goes a little bit deeper than this job, and maybe one day making it up to fry guy. No offense to the fry guys out there, but I figured in the military, I can get promoted. I can go get cool life experiences. I can get my education. They'll help me pay for my education. And so on and so forth. It will offer me a higher quality of life. But of course, there was a price to pay.
It's there's an investment. So, tell us you I see from the fact that you do the workout program primarily for vets, like many of the people that I know who've been in military service, it becomes a part of your life, and carries on. Tell us a little tiny bit, if you want to, about your service, where you served and how long you were in.
I served for 13 years in Canada. First half of that was doing sailor stuff. I joined the
Okay.
Navy and I joined up as what was then called a Mars officer. Mars was a narcissistic reference to the god of war, but also an acronym that stood for maritime surface and subsurface. We're basically the guys that drive the ships, who are on the bridge of the ships, kind of like a little bit like Star Trek, except fewer aliens. And we are basically crisis response people on the bridge of the ship and coordinators of the humans on the ship and communicators with external traffic and stuff like that, and the constant point of liaison for the captain, basically the right hand of the captain on the bridge of the ship. So I did that work for 6 or 7 years, weirdly, usually going north.
Okay.
So before I became this weird long-haired cosmopolitan bohemian hippie that you're talking to, I saw a lot of wasteland in the Arctic, Greenland, no offense, Greenland, Alaska, no offense, Alaska, and so forth, sailing on both coasts, going up north. Transitional time in my career began when I started working in military headquarters. Particularly in Ottawa, they figured out that I could write, so they enjoyed throwing all kinds of little writing projects. I became the personal aide slash editor slash ass wiper of various high-ranking officials. And eventually I started working in, what's that grimace? Yeah,
No,
sometimes you
I
gotta wipe an ass, Amy.
have
And then I started working in an operation centers, which are like, I don't know, dispatch centers. Equivalent of dispatch centers in a civilian world. And it was in that context that I eventually deployed to Afghanistan in 2010. And I served there for a year and came back about 10,000 years older. That's when I went back to school. I did a few more projects with the military, including developing a fair amount of drone warfare doctrine slash training. And then I did one extremely long pseudo professional rucksack march called the Nijmegen March, which is 160 kilometers over 4 days before I officially retired from the military and began my travels.
All right. Very, very good. So they found out you could write while you were in the military. How long have you felt like you wanted to be a writer, or is this something that you've known for a long time? Really, if I was to go back and ask the high school version or the middle school version of you if you wanted to be a writer when you grew up, would you have said yes, or what would you have said you wanted to do?
I would have definitely said yes. I think in high school, when I look back on my high school yearbook, which I never do, but it would say, I think I was voted the most likely to write a book one day.
Oh,
And
really? Okay.
when I was like 13 years old, I won my first writing contest. It was a story about a kid who burns down the school, naturally. And the writing was always on the wall that I was good at this one thing. But just because you're good at one thing doesn't mean there's a career in it.
That's true.
You kind of have to have a base and a voice and people who will buy your book and be chosen by publishers and be chosen by editors and learn the ropes. So when you're 20, it's pretty terrifying, I think, to jump directly into a creative career. Unless you get into the right MFA program and then you meet the right nerds who have the right connections. But people don't actually like me in that way. You know, I have to like work at developing relationships with people. It just doesn't fall into my outstretched hand like an apple. And at the same time, it's like it's nice when writers have gone and done something.
Yeah, no, of course. It's writing a book is one of those things. So many people say they want to do it. I read something a couple months ago that 8 out of 10 adults, if you surveyed them, if they wanted to write a book, they say yes. But not everybody does it, right? So you're in the military for 13 years, pretty long time. So you wanted to be a writer from a very early age. When you left the military after 13 years, did you jump straight into writing? Was that when you were able to do it, or was there something else that you did as sort of a bridge before you were writing?
Yeah, fair enough. I'd say about the riddle of everyone wanting to write a book, there is some kind of like narcissistic fantasy about writing the book where you're like, and all the attention will be on me and it will be glorious. The actual reality, as I mentioned a bit before we turned on the recording, it's like a grueling, lonely process. And it's like learning to play the piano and you got to go spend 7 years by yourself learning all the chords and grinding your chords. And then finally, you accumulate the skills and you start to get publications and stuff like that. And then at some point along your writing career, you realize the only way that this job and this vocation is going to be satisfying and fulfilling is if I write a book that's actually bigger than my own ego. So you actually have to kind of crush slash squash the ego on the very journey that perhaps you began as an ego trip. So I think it's important to write a book that's like bigger than you. That's where themes come in. You want to hold on to those important themes. So when I left the military, I immediately became a unemployed guy with a undergrad and a master's in literature. And it was like, oh shit, what do I do with this? So my then partner was volunteering in Nicaragua. So I followed her to Nicaragua, but because I had zero Spanish skill, they didn't accept me as a volunteer. But I just went because suddenly I had no gig. And ended up being quite important because capital, Managua, at that time, at least, maybe to this day, I'm not sure, wasn't super safe. We had to get potable water from the grocery store. So every other day I would get this huge jug of water and carry the water back, and I was a useful pack mule. And every day my partner would go off to work and I would write. And
Okay.
that was when I developed the discipline of daily writing, as well as during the master's itself when I was volunteering at a poetry magazine. And I ended up being the artistic director of a poetry festival and I met a bunch of nerds that way. So even as I was kind of leaving the military, I was starting to network and connect and be inspired by people who were kind of deeper in the tunnel. While in Nicaragua, I got a job teaching at a university in China.
Okay, big jump.
I got a gig in the town of Jinjiang, which I've just brutally mispronounced, teaching English to a bunch of diligent students. I'm going to call them diligent, kindly. And so I spent a year after that teaching in China. If you want to talk about transitional journeys, I have been a teacher for 10 years
Okay.
as my writing career ramps up. But at the beginning of this transition, leaving the military, I was teaching mostly English and then finally made my way to Paris. And increasingly, my teaching is getting weirder, which
What do you mean by that?
I think is a good sign that I'm doing what I'm supposed to. Well, for example, I teach at this one university, Sciences Politiques or Sciences Po, which is one of the most prestigious in France. They've let me into the door, and I teach three classes there. One of them is on creativity and the writer's craft, so
Okay.
it's just an excuse to get my students to buy my book. Actually, no, I'm joking. In case any of them are listening to the podcast, I do my best to teach them the things that I've been learning over the last decade. The other one is rhetoric, the
Budget.
skill of bullshitting each other, which obviously I think I do well. And the third course is monsters.
So are you teaching at Sciences Po? You're teaching in English or in French?
In English.
Okay.
I also teach leadership at the École Militaire. I think that's probably in the bio somewhere. Pitched a school recently. I said, hire me to teach word math to engineers.
Okay.
Just we'll do advanced grammar, we'll make it nerdy, and I'll trick them into doing poetry at the end. I've done a lot of public speaking stuff, and I said, okay, I will even teach low-level English students, and we'll call the course Pirates. Day one, you roll your character, you character generate your pirate, and then every week I'll just come in with a different pirate adventure, and I won't even pretend to teach them English. We'll just do pirate adventures, and by the end they'll be like, "Oh shit, now I'm fluent. How did that happen?" I'll just again trick them into learning English through a pirate journey.
Very good. So the students that you're teaching in English now, are they French students who speak English or are they international students?
A combination.
A combination. Okay.
Largely French, but also some internationals.
Okay. Yeah. No, just curious. Not on topic, but I was just curious. So the all right. So you knew that you wanted to be a writer when you left the military. You describe it as being the precarious career of being a writer, which I think you've sort of fleshed out on already, that you have all these teaching gigs while you're also writing. Before you did this, before you left the military and went on to just really boldly with your master's degree in literature and your experience in a poetry festival, what were your fears and concerns about making this leap, or did you not have any?
Well, going from a job with let's call it a fat pension,
Okay.
medical coverage,
Sure.
dental plan, and career advancement, the same things that drew me into the military in the first place, in my position of precarity, ch scraping out the nacho cheese, were the things that made it difficult to leave. I think the military can kind of become a second adolescence for people. Particularly if they're a bit messed up, if they've got some trauma or whatever that they're carrying around, and they don't actually need to leap forward into adulthood. They can just have a new angrier mom and dad who they'll call like the sergeant and the captain or whatever. And then, suspend snooze button the hard work of growing up and showing up for your life. But like they're after Afghanistan, I was involved in drone war.
Yeah.
So there became a moment of like, the price is actually pretty high, and there's a good chance I wasn't actually, put on this earth to be a human weapon. There's a good
Yeah.
chance that my creativity is not for hurting people, and indeed, I'm perhaps better suited for communicating, reaching, helping, healing, instead of, rationalized, justified, codified murder.
And that is how, so that was the equation going on in your head where, one became clearly motivation to make the change. So,
Well, when I came home from Afghanistan, having spent a year watching super violence, turbo
right,
violence,
active war,
screen,
yeah.
and it's a new kind of form of warfare where all of the images of the killing can get like filtered back into one central node. And so by the time I was going home, the first few months, particularly when I was back in Canada, every time I closed my eyes, the video, this like montage of people blowing up would just be playing in my head. And I
But
would
it
have
wasn't a movie. It was stuff you had actually seen.
very intense flashbacks, even when I was going back to school. I remember one professor was writing on the board and the chalk broke. And I had a flashback of seeing someone like holding their own intestines. And I was just like in the moment, in the class, back in the war. And I think I had just reached a limit. I think each of us has a limit of how much, violence and poison we're willing to put into our heads. I think military and perhaps the culture of being a dude is really good at telling us our feelings don't exist or our feelings don't matter, but they seem to catch up with us. They seem to catch up with us and let us know when something's broken.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, trauma is a popular word in 2025, but the most defined example of it is the experience of the soldier in both ways, how to, prepare people to go against their instincts. Like your instinct would be to run away from violence, but how to charge in, how to keep going when you don't want to be there. And then the second part, which is less, but hopefully becoming more, which is how to help people reacclimate when they've experienced something so overwhelming.
Yeah, I mean, soldiers don't have the monopoly on trauma or
They
on death.
don't, but it is the most easily, like the two big examples that are easy for people to understand because they are so extreme are soldiers and first responders, and then also like extreme accidents, like plane crashes, car crashes, stuff like that. Those are easy for people.
Yeah, and the example of, okay, last month we had a super tough, physically near invincible man in the prime of his strength and health, and this month we have a broken guy who cries in the
Yeah.
supermarket. Like, it's quite dramatic to go from fully functioning Turbo Man to, oh my God, my feelings have taken over my body, or I'm messed up and back in war. But if I had to point to the most common, source of trauma in human history, I'd probably just say childhood.
Well, childhood, yes. No, absolutely. Absolutely. One of my kids, I've got a bunch of kids, and when one of my kids was little, the pediatrician said, I don't know why people talk about childhood as being easy. It's like it's constant hardship. You know, it's like everything is hard.
Yeah,
So, yeah.
yeah. Everything feels larger than life, and destabilizing things when you're a kid last forever
Right.
and
And you have, yeah.
mark our personalities forever. You know,
Absolutely.
a traumatized
So,
30-year-old emerges at some point, but a traumatized like 6-year-old, 4-year-old, or whatever, like you're gonna, at some point, everyone's got to go and do the work, basically.
at some point, everyone's got to go and do the work. That's true. So you gave us the story, the moving that you did afterwards. So you grew up in Canada, and you when you came back, you then went to Nicaragua, which you shared with us that part. You went to China. Now you're in France. Is there a reason or a story behind why you didn't go back to Canada?
Well, there was a series of cliches.
Okay.
Sometimes that's all we have. There's a series of cliches. The first one being the cliche of Paris in love.
Yeah.
I was here with my ex, and she kind of had the dream job, and that kept us here for a long time. And then after that, I transitioned, or we broke up, and I stayed with the second cliche, which is the cliche of Paris as this hub of the artistic life,
Oh, I love it. Okay.
which of course it is, so I was enmeshed, or I felt enmeshed, perhaps I'm still enmeshed in these, culture, cheese, champagne, beautiful bohemian hangouts, parties, clever people, banter, delicious, riding home on your rented bicycle at 3 in the morning, too drunk to stay on the road. Like there was a certain magic to Paris. And the thing, it's like, I'm not making this up either. Like, the cliche of the art life in Paris is quite real. But then at a certain point, I've withdrawn somewhat, not completely, from the art life in order to focus on my actual projects and being a writer and being an independent person who makes money and teaches and lives and is an enthusiastic cat dad. And now I think I'm here because over the last 8 years, the people have become another family to me.
Best place to be there. Best reason.
Growing up, things were tenuous. Things were kind of fragile in the family. So I learned to imprint onto friend groups and treat friends as family. And I try to go home every year back to Canada to stay invested in those family slash friends as well. But it is hard to stand in two worlds.
Sure. No, absolutely. Paris is one of the world's greatest cities. I think it's on every list of top cities in the world. And so I don't know. I don't know that you would have had to give me too much of a sales pitch for why you choose to live in Paris, but it is always curious when people don't move home. So now, when did you start writing the book that is out now? You have a book out, and so I think this is your first book.
This is the first published book, the second or third book I've written, and that's the
Okay.
way it goes.
Yeah.
So when I was in China, I was working on my first book, and then I spent maybe a year or two editing it and polishing it. And then I started working on this Predators, Reapers, and Deadlier Creatures, then called simply Drones. Although Drones, the word changed and it became a children's toy that I see in the park. I'm like, ah! Oh, it's just the modern kite now, but
Yeah.
in those days the drone was an arm drone, or it was for me. So then I'd say I worked on it for a good like 4 years. I've done more than 10 drafts. I've had about 15 editors work on this thing. I got a grant from the Canada Art Council at one point, so allowing me to pay a bunch of editors to help me. Ran it through many, many, many hours of workshopping. Got an agent, got some edits, lost the agent, got another agent, got some more edits, got a publishing house, lost the publishing house, got a new publishing house. Just like the writing was years, and then the getting of the publication has been a stormy roller coaster, up and down, wild ride
I
of
believe it.
resilience and pure human stubbornness.
And so, well, I've never heard, well, I suppose because I'm not talking to people who had the easy experience, but there's only one publishing story I have of somebody who had an easy publishing experience. I interviewed somebody who did a book about Kurt Cobain, and she emailed blind emailed Genius Publishing with her idea, and they were like, yes, and that was it. She then went and wrote the book. But other
Nonfiction
than
book.
that, people generally have a frustrating experience or a long story about how they actually bring their book to creation. So, tell us about the book, and we're going to put the link for where people can find it in the show notes. And that goes out to everybody who subscribed at imperfectadulting.com. But tell us what it's about and how you had the idea to create it, and why it was worth 4 years of time to you.
Well, longer. I'm still
Longer.
talking it and hyping it and pushing it. The
Yeah.
book is called Predators, Reapers, and Deadlier Creatures. The simplest pitch I can give it is that it's about a drone operator in Afghanistan who doesn't want to kill. Along the path, he falls in love with his boss, which is a taboo relationship. The base is stalked by a taser rapist who preys on men. Underneath the barracks, the narrator discovers a gentle, kind-hearted, but brutish Sasquatch, and they develop a bizarre friendship. Is it real? Is the narrator losing his mind? We have no idea.
So
This.
it's like it's fiction, and it sounds like a tiny bit of like, I don't know, like so suspense or mystery or fantasy. How do you describe it?
I would describe it as a magic realism. I would
Okay.
describe it as a fusion of a hard nosed war story and a surrealistic critique and lampooning. I mean, when I look at where the publisher has put the book in the categories on Amazon, and it's all like absurdist literature and stuff like that, because it's like hypercritical of the war, but extremely pro-human,
Okay.
pro-soldier, pro-victim, pro-reader. If you'd like, I can read you a spicy excerpt.
Sure, let's do it. A spicy excerpt. I'm
Okay.
excited.
Well, not too spicy, because I can't give away any of the, can't give any away of the meat, but here we open almost at random. The day of the spark. I woke and reached for my dreams, but they had become starchy pages that crumbled when turned. When leaving the barracks, I always half expected that the world would have turned soft and green since I slept. Imagination painted a unicorn's glade of trees and vines, but it was always a manticore's heath of blowing sand. I avoided Tic Tac for 2 days after his meltdown, and the sun was a vicious bastard, too. I pulled my bush cap low over my eyes. On the walk to work, the stench of poo, pond, and meatloaf had blended and swept over the camp. Paused at the mess to eat an omelet and found a tasty treat inside, a cigarette butt. Just outside the cafeteria, I stopped. There was a drone. I was so used to looking through them, but never at them. On the other side of a fence, the drone idled on the tarmac in front of a bunker. It stood as tall as I did, shark-like, with two pectoral fins that extended from its sides like a traditional plane. Yet the stabilizing fins at the tail pointed down in an inverse V. Gray with white patches, a camouflage of cloud. The most disconcerting thing was its eyelessness. Easy to imagine planes with cockpits and windows and World War II pilots mummified in looping scarves. Not these flying robots. piloted by science and logic. The drone seemed to have a face, but without eyes, it was blank, expressionless. Instead, it saw through hypersensitive nodes on the back of its neck and chin. Drones have no agency. They obey the voices in their heads, clutching close their clusters of bombs, four in each armpit. This type of drone was the Predator, little brother of Reaper. I met its unblinking gaze for a moment. Truly, it was a predator, as unfeeling as they wanted us to be. Its job was to hide in clouds or the glare of the sun, to lurk behind bunkers with a taser. When Predator was a child, he was never invited to picnics. His hands were full of missiles that he thought were flowers. He was a strange boy, too quiet. Always muttering to himself and wanting to be older so his bombs would drop, always rubbing his nose on the legs of teachers. No one wants to be your friend, Predator. The only thing you know how to do is assassinate people. You think because you're unmanned, you can cross borders and kill in other lands and no one will think that is war? You're on the wrong side of history. You could be so noble, flying into radioactive areas, dumping water on thirsty crops, detonating yourself in the eyes of Sharknadoes. But you were seized early by powerful men and made a weapon, same as the rest of us.
Very nice. I like the Sharknado reference. Anytime that I'm coming up with an idea that I'm wondering if it's a good idea, I sometimes remind myself that they made more than one version of that movie, which means that there were maybe hundreds of meetings where they got together and said, "Is this a good idea? Should we make a movie about tornadoes with sharks in them?" And people said yes over and over again. So
There's like six of those
there's a
movies.
bunch of them. There's a bunch of them. All right. So very good. So in a minute, so are you ready? Let's close this up with some random fun questions.
Well, I could. We could definitely. I do like random fun. I see. Okay, the book is called Predators, Reapers, and Deadlier Creatures, right? So the
Yep.
Predator and the Reaper are the names of armed drones. And the
Yep.
implication, oh, the deadlier creature, is it a Bigfoot? We don't even know. So that was my critique of the Predator that I just read.
Yep.
If you'd like balance, and you could also just edit me out later,
right.
I could read the Reaper
Sure,
in
let's do
Reaper,
it. Let's do it.
and then bring on your bizarre questions, the
All
weirder.
right. They're not so bizarre, they're just random. Okay. But yes, let's hear from the Reaper.
The first day of the fighting season started typically. I left the dining facility with heartburn and the taste of cigarette butts in my mouth. I had only eaten cucumbers. I walked past the little airfield where I had once seen a predator and over a short fence spotted a new drone. It was twice the size and length of its little brother, uglier and lumpier, bulging at the nose for the communications package and at the rear for the larger engines. Its skin was a cool gray and smooth, lacking seams. This was the Reaper, the size of a jet plane, but with its rear fins jutting diagonally upwards, an aggressive posture, like a cobra poised to strike. Still no face, though. It had no eyes, and no smile, and no expression, and no anger, just the impression of a brutish sloping forehead and overdeveloped jaw. Packed in its chest was not a thrumming heart, but instead 400 or 500 pound bombs. That's enough power to flatten a village or gouge a mountain. When it has dropped its deadly payload, there is no pilot to feel remorse. Not that grief ever brought anyone back to life. Back in robot grade school, Reaper wore glasses. He could barely see at all. Bull-necked, barrel-chested, he was too strong to care. He was blind as he bit the head off the class gerbil. He flushed our goldfish, Bubbles. The boys played King of the Castle, and Reaper clawed his way to the top of the playground and defended his perch so viciously that he killed the game. So he stood there alone on the top of the playground for the rest of the lunch hour, gloating. You were never like the other kids, Reaper. You liked hurting people and you didn't care who. There is no tragic loss in you, no wasted potential for good. Deep down, you are always a mass killer, one who reaps the innocent and guilty alike. You will only ever be a blunt instrument of genocide. So long as the feeblest spark of love or joy animates our species, there will always be someone, no matter how small and ineffective, to raise a pen against your ugliness and dub you abomination, horrific, blurry-eyed dragon with the breath of the sun. And so I spat the taste of cucumbers and cigarette butts directly at the eyeless face, watched the fluid trickle, run down, drip. Fuck you, Reaper. I'm never going to be like you. I live for a future where you are scrapped in endless fields of waste and rust, an airplane graveyard of tangled wings. I will fucking dance when the last of you is slain.
All right.
Part of
So
my
I
challenge.
know you're in the throes of promoting this book, but I'm curious whether or not you have other book ideas ba and story ideas bouncing around in your head. And I'm sure you do because you're a writer. But do you think that you'll stay in this theme of military drone warfare type stories?
I think the only way I would write another war book, like a full war book like this, would be if there was some kind of extremely generous offer.
Okay, so you think this is it on this topic?
I just broke my heart multiple times writing the book, and dug open things that, oh, maybe I needed to dig open, but at the same time, I deserve some peace like everybody else.
Yeah, so did you start this based on you started this based on personal experience and your knowledge in the area? Was it helpful or just torturous to go through this plot line and see it in this kind of thing, given the fact that you were this is what you did for such a long time?
Well, because it's a fusion of reality and surrealism, because I could put in hilarious characters, because I am a jokester, as you can see talking to me,
Yeah.
I did have a lot of fun when writing it as well.
Okay.
For every time I made myself cry, I made myself laugh. And I think because I'm a weird little empath who's seen too much, a lot of that goes into the book.
That is,
But I do have other ideas. Okay, so I've been teaching at this the School of War, the École Militaire in Paris for like 5 years now. I've been teaching these hardened soldiers because, I mentioned standing in two worlds, and now I stand in the civilian and the military world all the time too. And partly having gone down, the PTSD journey and gone and gotten all the therapy and written through all of my experiences and stuff, and then seeing these guys who are still in it, I've become the toxic man whisperer.
Well, because you've walked the journey. Yeah.
So I think the next book will have to do with leadership and having been exposed to hundreds of these incredible leaders and personalities, and being this kind of bruised veteran guy and writer nerd encountering all of these leaders. I've sketched out the next book. I've written about 50 pages of it, but can I apply myself to it every day? No, I cannot. So it remains the next project.
I think there's, you mentioned that everybody's got trauma and everybody's got stories in the childhood. And one of the things that makes that so hard is that the people, it's very hard when you're going through it to know that it's happening to you, which just means it's very important for people who've stood in both sides to help people identify the people around them who are suffering when they're suffering themselves and be the people who help them walk the next few steps. So the leadership book is probably pretty important.
I think we live in a very strange time
That is definitely something we can agree on.
to make the understatement of the century. And one of the things that's so fragile and messed up about our time is the lack of trust and warmth between the genders,
Sure.
the sexes, and you and I, this conversation being quite amicable, being an exception to all of the wounds that men carry and women carry, and the historical wounds that we seem to carry around and have accumulated. And I spend a lot of time thinking, how do we get through this moment of mutual resentment and move into towards a world of peace? And for me, that means we need to heal men. We need to heal the brokenness of men and give them back their feelings. We also need to heal women. But
Right.
my mission is to heal men.
No, which is very important. And one of the things that is the purpose of this podcast and talking to people about the choices they've made and the story and the way it impacts their life is that a lot of times when we're in a spot to make a choice, whether it's joining the military, leaving the military, writing a book, starting a family, breaking up with somebody, the people who surround us are very much in the same position we are. They're our same age. They're at the same spot in the problem. And so listening to people who can tell a story from, this is why I think I did this. This is how this choice impacted me. These are the things. that hopefully will bridge age gaps and people will be able to hear opportunities and why it's okay to make decisions, you know, what happens when we do these things and what the choices are as sort of, you know, be heard and the benefit of other people's stories.
Well, we spoke at the beginning. You asked me, and it was kind of like a map. Why didn't you just become a writer immediately?
Right.
And I look back, and it's hard for me to truly regret the decisions that I've made, because my book is all about the war, and my what I've learned have been the difficult things that I've learned through crazy experiences. And I have more to say now than I would in a more human perspective. I had to go and have my heart broken a few times in order to speak for the humans, you know? So it's impossible for me to regret the path that I've taken, because it's how I got here. And it is a big step to become an artist and to say, oh yeah, that's what I do now. And if you try to do it when you're 20, you're going to be competing with guys and girls who are 40
Yeah.
and have been doing it for a long time. So everyone's always going to try to find their own path through it, and using the experiences that they've had as the fodder. And I recognize what you've said as well, Amy. And you're like, you know what, Matt? I'm a healer too, and I bridge people together. And you are, Amy, and I see it. And thank you.
You're
Thank you.
welcome. All right, now I'm going to ask you some. So now I'm going to ask you some ridiculous questions, and we're going to close this up, and I will release you to your day because it's late where you are. It's still mid-afternoon where I am, but you're ahead in time. All right, so three random questions. Is there a food item that reminds you of childhood and home?
Boiled turnip.
Really?
Oh,
I don't think I've ever had, I guess I have turnip mashed, no, that's parsnips. I don't think I've ever had boiled turnips. What in the world does that, what, that was a meal you had growing up?
the smell of cabbage farts.
Oh, yes, well, okay. All right. Fair enough.
Everything boiled.
Everything boiled.
My
All right.
parents are both from Newfoundland on the east coast of Canada, which is a beautiful place where the humans are very warm. But the culinary culture is not that advanced. So I enjoy trolling my mom when she listens to my interviews and she sees me taking these jabs at the turnip and the cabbage rolls. But for my aunts who make me the cabbage rolls, please keep making the cabbage rolls.
Cabbage rolls, got it. All right. When you want to relax, what is something that you do?
Well, as you've noticed, I have an emotional support cat. And even when I was doing the reading of the Predator and Reaper excerpts and allowing my voice to pick up and get a little bit more elevated for a little theatricality on your podcast, the cat jumped up onto the table, sniffed my face, rubbed her little head against my beard, and was like, does he need to be soothed? Or is he just acting again? She made a snap judgment and was like, hey, he's fine. And then she carried on and went, I don't know, cleaning herself or whatever it is she's doing. So we have a number of games that are very good for my blood pressure. The most popular being Sandworm.
Okay.
She goes under the sheet and just allows her viciousness to escape. And under the safety of the sheet, I can poke her and she'll snarl and spit and try to claw me. And it's the only way she can be 100% aggressive without destroying me. So
Oh, so sandworm, like in from Dune, like the like yeah.
I dropped the pop culture references.
There you go. Get
Or
it.
Beetlejuice.
Or okay. All
Yeah.
right. Very good.
We can
Very
drop
good.
that reference. They remade that movie.
Yes. No. Absolutely. And absolutely. So, all right. What is something that today, like a talent or a skill? This is not a serious question. This is a random just discussion question. A talent or a skill that you cannot do today, but you really wish you would someday be able to do it. Maybe you'll try and learn it someday, or maybe it'll be something you'll never be able to do.
I have so many legitimate answers to this question.
Just pick one. First one to come to mind.
Well, I would like to speak French as well as I speak English.
Okay.
I would like to write French as well as I write English. And that's very, very intimidating. But I can order a croissant now. which took a long time even to get to that level, because when I first showed up, the lady at the boulangerie would just refuse to understand my terrible accent. I would have to point at the croissant like a gorilla. And then eventually I would get a croissant out of her. So today I can actually get one without reducing my dignity.
I have lived that experience. I did my last year of college in France, and the first couple of weeks I was there, ordering breakfast, pain avec beurre, they would not listen to me, like because I was not pronouncing it the correct way. So just trying to get my cafeteria bread and butter and coffee in the morning was there. My other hilarious story from that that you'll enjoy is that I was in school as an American taking French classes, and we were reading Albert Camus' The Stranger, and I got so confused reading it in French. It was all French because it begins with the sand and the desert and all of these things that I went to the bookstore and found the English version to verify that I understood what I was reading. I was like, is this really just about the sand coming in through the window? And I was like, I can't believe it. And I was like, oh, I am understanding what I'm reading. Okay,
It's
back
just
to
messing
work.
with my mind. Yeah,
Yes,
I
exactly.
mean,
It's just absurd. And so,
everywhere you go, I think we'll encounter one of the things I've discovered traveling around. You're going to encounter a kind of national ego. People are always going to be proud and thorny about certain things. I mean, we see this now with the threats to annex Canada, and Canadian nationalism is rising, and we're all just like, we're a sovereign nation. We really love being our own nation. And for some people, this is quite shocking, but it's like, no. We can be thorny and proud about who we are and, history of being there for our allies. Does it hurt me personally, having served in an American war, to have, the saber being rattled at Canada? It does. It does a lot, because I went and did my part and more for you, for your country.
It is a very strange time to be alive in the United States, and probably everywhere, but definitely it is a peculiar time to try and read the news and figure out what is going on. But that's it. Matthew Jones, thank you for being a wonderful guest today on The Art of Imperfect Adulting.
Absolute pleasure to be here, Amy. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.